Mark chapter 14, verses 53 through 72. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes were assembled. Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards, warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were looking for testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many gave false testimony against him, and their testimony did not agree. Some stood up and gave false testimony against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands.'" But even on this point of their testimony, they did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer? What is it that they testify against you?" But he was silent and did not answer. Again the high priest asked him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "Why do we still need witnesses? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?" All of them condemned him as deserving death. Some began to spit on him, to blindfold him, and to strike him, saying to him, "Prophesy!" The guards also took him over and beat him. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she stared at him and said, "You also were with Jesus, the man from Nazareth." But he denied it, saying, "I do not know or understand what you are talking about." And he went out into the forecourt. Then the cock crowed. And the servant girl, on seeing him, began again to say to the bystanders, "This man is one of them." But again he denied it. Then after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, "Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." But he began to curse, and he swore an oath, "I do not know this man you are talking about." At that moment the cock crowed for the second time. Then Peter remembered that Jesus had said to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you will deny me 3 times." And he broke down and wept. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
So they have Jesus in custody, and they take him to the home of the high priest, who was Caiaphas that year. He was the son-in-law of Annas, who preceded him. And Annas still pulled a lot of weight behind the scenes. Caiaphas held the position of high priest longer than anybody else in the first century, from 18 until 37 A.D. And based on what we've learned from archaeological excavations, this home of the high priest overlooking the Temple Mount was a pretty imposing structure. It was 2,000 square feet. Now, to us today, 2,000 square feet is not a lot of room, but 2,000 years ago, a 2,000 square foot home was palatial. There's some controversy about who was gathered there. Oftentimes the word associated with this court is the Sanhedrin, which was kind of like the council of elders, and it would have consisted of the priests, not just the high priest, the elders, some Sadducees, and these groups were overlapping. So there could have also been people described elsewhere in Mark as scribes who were also present. And the question is, was this a fixed grouping of leaders, or was it a more ad hoc organization? It's really hard to say. We don't have clear historical accounts of the composition of it, of this body and its full function. It was, though, an irregular trial. Around 200 A.D., a compendium of rules was sort of brought together in its final form. It's called the Mishnah, and additions were made afterwards. But in this edition, there are a sequence of regulations about how to conduct a trial. Now, some people would say this was, you know, more than 100 years after Jesus' trial, and so we have no way of knowing if these applied. But they didn't just make these up whole cloth. And so there's reason to believe that at least some, if not all, of these rules would have applied to Jesus' trial. And among the regulations set forth in the Mishnah is that if you put somebody on trial, it has to happen during the daytime. It has to meet where the court usually meets. You have to start with witnesses for the defendant, innocent until proven guilty. And then prosecutorial testimony then comes afterwards. You cannot make a judgment the day of or the day before a high holy day. You had to allow one day to elapse between the trial and passing verdict and sentencing. And the charge of blasphemy could only be made and proven if a person had used the tetragrammaton, that is God's holy and sacred name, Yahweh. It's called the tetragrammaton because it's the transliteration of it from Hebrew is YHWH. The vowels aren't in there because it was believed that only the high priest knew how to pronounce it properly and that it could only be said one day a year in the holiest of holies, whether tabernacle or temple, as a way to call upon God's mercy to expiate the sins of the people. Okay, Jesus did not say that word, and basically everything that's in the Mishnah was violated. The trial was at night. It wasn't where this group would have normally met. It was held in the house of the high priest. There apparently was no defense counsel present. It was just a series of accusations and false testimonies that were offered. In the same session as the trial, they announced the verdict and declared the sentence. And so they did it the evening of Passover. So in accordance with the rules of Mishnah, all of this was wrong. And I think that these laws, which were promulgated and finally assembled in the period after the destruction of the temple, which would have essentially eliminated the relevancy of the priests and the Sadducees to a certain extent. Basically, after the temple went down, the Pharisees took over. They shaped what we now know as modern Judaism. And, you know, as they're trying to determine how do we put somebody on trial, one would think that they would have had sufficient recollection to say, well, this is how we handled it back in the day. And so I would think that the Mishnah produced in around about 200 AD, based on oral and fragmentary written sources, is probably reflective of what the rules were when Jesus was put on trial. And, you know, they were desperate. It was an urgent situation. Not only was Jesus undermining their authority, but he was popular. It was Passover. Jerusalem was a tinderbox of religious intensity. They were concerned that he might create civil unrest. And the Romans didn't like civil unrest. And they often responded to it violently, indiscriminately, because they wanted to resolve the situation as quickly as they could. They didn't want it to gain momentum. Also, it's hard to collect taxes and facilitate commerce when the population's in an uproar. And that's pretty much what they were concerned about in their outlying provinces. Taxes and the regulation of commerce, which is basically the same thing. So this is a kangaroo court. This is a mock trial. And somehow Peter, and we have to give him credit, because by the end of the chapter he's not looking so good, but Peter did follow him at a distance and actually had the temerity to go into the courtyard of the high priest. And the challenge here, though, is not dissimilar to what we faced last week in Gethsemane when Jesus was praying. How do we know what he was praying if the disciples were asleep the whole time? And so how can we know what happened in the trial, including some direct quotations, if Peter was in the courtyard? He would not have been able to hear. There are a lot of hypotheses. After the resurrection, Jesus told them all about it. It's possible that members who were in the room as part of this Supreme Court, if you will, talked about it afterwards. or maybe there were these household servants who were kind of going in and out, in and out, and they were kind of relaying, you know, what was going on, you know, kind of like an ancient day Twitter, and that's how Peter got his information. I don't think that there's any reason to suspect that, you know, the story that we have is made up. It's hard to say how we got this information. Other Gospels would say, well, there were some secret followers of Jesus who were members of the Sanhedrin, and of course that would be a natural source of information. But Mark doesn't mention that. It doesn't mean that there weren't secret followers of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark, but that's kind of a detail you might want to include. The only piece of false testimony specified in the trial is the claim that Jesus said that he would tear down the temple and then rebuild it in 3 days. Now, this is either a twisting of what Jesus said in chapter 13, verse 2, where he told the disciples, presumably in a place where others might have been able to overhear it, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." So that could be interpreted in a variety of different ways. I mean, there are biases, you know, so if you didn't like Jesus to start with, it would be sort of easy to read between the lines, even if there wasn't any room between the lines. Or maybe they're embellishing in an attempt to provide a convictable offense. But it says in verse 59 that even on this, they couldn't get their story straight. And so they're basically stuck. And the high priest gets up, and Jesus has remained silent, and he demands an answer out of Jesus, but he won't give him one. And this may be a sign. We spoke last week that in this entire passion sequence, Jesus speaks less and less and less and less. And so it may be that he already knows what's going to happen. He's prophesied this all, so speaking doesn't make any difference. It could be that he doesn't really have anything to say. It may be that his silence is a sign of his greater dignity in the midst of this frenzy of accusations. Or it could be, it just might be, that what he did say was close enough to what he's being accused of that it's just better to keep quiet at this point. But for whatever reason, he stays silent. And then the high priest asks him a direct question. "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" And in verse 62, depending on the translation of the Bible you have, and I'm using the New Revised Standard Version, the NRSV, it says, "I am." But your version might say, "You say it so." And this is actually an important detail. The oldest manuscripts we have of Mark are pretty much divided. And it's not a big difference. It's just like a little word in Greek that makes all the difference. But why does it matter? Well, "I am" is a direct admission. "You say so" is a much more coy way of going about it. And in fact, as we'll see in chapter 15, when Jesus goes on trial with Pilate, Pilate asks a similar question, and Jesus tells him, "You say so." And there's no debate about the translation on that in the ancient sources. When you look at the broader context of Mark, how evasive Jesus was when he was asked a direct question, when you consider how carefully he guarded the secret of his identity, because the true nature of his identity could only be revealed on the cross and in the empty tomb, I would say that it's more likely he responded to the high priest with, "You say so." Either way, though, I think it would have been plenty to offend the high priest, make him draw his conclusions, and declare Jesus guilty of blasphemy. And what Jesus went on to say in verse 62 does not make it any better. Blending a quotation from Daniel chapter 7 and Psalm 110, verse 1, he says, "I am," and, quote, "You will see the Son of Man, Daniel, seated at the right hand of the power," Psalm, "and coming with the clouds of heaven." And the power, with a capital P, was sort of a way of respectfully referring to God. Okay, it was just one of the other titles that God had in the ancient world. And so Jesus by saying that he's going to be seated at the right hand of God, there's a sense of equality implied there. In other words, it could be easily inferred from what he said that he is saying that he is God. So the high priest tears his clothes. It was not an unusual action. In fact, that Mishnah that we mentioned before said that if somebody blasphemes, the appropriate response is to tear your clothes. It was sort of, I'm trying to think of a contemporary equivalent of expressing outrage. It's interesting because in Leviticus chapter 21, verse 10, the high priest is instructed not to tear their sacred clothing. And we don't know whether the chief priest was wearing his sacred robes or not. It's an important occasion. It's a trial. He's acting in the capacity of his office. So presumably he was, but maybe that was only reserved for the work that he did in the temple. But presuming he had them on, it's kind of ironic because Jesus is being condemned for violating the law, and then immediately the person condemning him violates the law himself. Possibly. Of course, Jesus' offense was much worse, and they very quickly moved to a decision, condemn him to death, and then he begins to endure physical abuse, not just from the soldiers, the guards, but also from the members of the council themselves, and the details, spitting him, striking him, demanding that he prophesy. These are all reminiscent of the suffering servant motif that you'll find in Isaiah chapters 50 through 53. And again, a note of irony in verse 65 where they demand that he prophesy. Well, he has been for the entirety of his ministry, and he has prophesied about this moment multiple times. So even as the prophecy is being fulfilled, prophecies that they were no doubt aware of, prophecies that they were playing a major role in fulfilling, they demand that he prophesies. And it just shows their blindness, their deafness. Remember, those with ears to hear, listen, from so many of the parables that he told. It shows their hardness of heart. And so he endures this abuse, and as this is happening, Peter's down in the courtyard. And a servant girl of the high priest comes by and says, "Hey, you're one of these Jesus guys." He's like, "I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just trying to stay warm." And he departs the courtyard for the forecourt. So he's making these denials as he is physically distancing himself from Jesus. Okay? And again, this servant girl says to others, "Hey, this guy is one of these Jesus freaks." And he says again, "No, I think you've got me confused with somebody else." And finally, the people gathered around him, not just this one person, but a lot of people started saying, "You know, you got to be with Jesus because you're Galilean." Now, how would they have known that? Well, Matthew cleans it up a little bit in chapter 26, verse 73. Matthew says they knew he was a Galilean because of his accent. You know, so it'd be like being in New York, your friend's on trial, you're afraid of being implicated in his crimes by association, you're from Mississippi. And you're sort of standing outside the courtroom, and people are like, "Well, you must have been with him because we can tell you're from Mississippi by the way you talk." And but Mark doesn't mention that detail. Thank you, Matthew, for giving us a clue. And then he cursed and he swore an oath. And that was a big deal back then, to swear an oath. And we don't know what he's cursing, but one has to wonder, was he cursing Jesus as a way to demonstrate the fact that he wasn't a follower? Mark doesn't tell us. In fact, none of the Gospels tell us. But it may be that he was cursing Jesus, and that for appearances' sake, this was a detail they chose not to include. It's a speculation, but We don't know if the crowd bought it or not, because the cock crows for the second time. And generally, I mean, roosters crow all the time. You cannot get them to stop. But basically, the thought was the second cock crow, the first one precedes dawn. The second cock crow is indicative of dawn, like a dawn. And suddenly, Peter remembers and realizes that the prophecy Jesus had made has come true, and he weeps. Because he's failed himself, he's failed his rabbi. So it's a rapidly moving, very intense narrative, very rich, you know, what are you seeing that I'm not? What are your questions about what's going on here? Yes, Caroline.
Why was tearing clothes considered to be anything? I mean, what was the deal with the tearing of the clothes?
I can't remember. I think that, you know, to tear your clothes would expose yourself. You know, clothing was valuable. You know, it's not like you could go to Target and pick up a shirt made in Cambodia for $18. And particularly if you were wealthy, I mean, your clothes would have been very valuable and not easy to replace. It would have taken time to make these. I just think that it's, I don't know, I'm trying to think what a modern-day equivalent to that, you know, might be. Hitting the TV with a baseball bat when your team's playing really lousy, like Louisville did against Clemson. I don't know.
Also, clothes are not really easy to tear. I
mean, yeah, it takes quite a bit of strength. Yeah.
It's almost like he's denouncing his position as much as what he's hurt. It's like he's saying, I can't do this.
Yeah.
Well,
maybe the tearing of the clothes was a symbol of the defilement, you know.
Only he had spoken words out of his mouth.
Exactly.
And therefore he was tearing off what was defiled.
Yeah, it's possible that, you know, the utterance of blasphemy was a polluting thing. And, of course, the chief priest is being representative of the holy, essentially, for the people. He was their chief liaison with God. Maybe this garment, having been exposed to this blasphemous utterance, was no longer usable. I mean, I don't know. I'll try to remember to look it up between now and then. Paul and then Fofo.
In the tearing of the clothes, denouncing the situation or the person that you're having a conflict with, I thought I remembered hearing that somewhere.
That he tears the clothes to represent the punishment that will be.
David and I were having a big argument.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying.
Yeah.
I would rip my clothes, denouncing him, and basically I was just screaming.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a gesture expressing outrage, you know, and why it's that and not something else, you know. I can only speculate because I can't remember. I think I knew that at one point, and I stuck something in one ear yesterday, and that was what ended up having to go out of the hard drive. Fofo, you got something for me?
A cheat sheet says the sign of great grief or shock, and then it says in the case of the high priest, it was a form of judicial act expressing the fact that he regarded Jesus' answers as blasphemous. And it refers you back to Genesis and to Kings, which I will look up while you're going on to see if I find anything else.
This is pretty similar. It was an expression of severe distress. Usually this was done in a time of mourning, sorrow, or offense. A tearing in his robes, Caiaphas is expressing deep offense at the claim of Jesus.
And, you know, in a way, this is a foreshadowing of what will happen when Jesus dies. I don't want, sorry about the spoilers, but in chapter 15, verse 38, when Jesus dies, immediately the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Yeah, well, in tearing of the temple, you know, there was a curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from the rest of the temple proper. So there was like an antechamber, and then beyond this curtain was, you know, that was where God was believed to dwell. And the tearing of the curtain could have a number of different interpretations. But, you know, Jesus had talked about how this temple made with human hands would be destroyed. That was the accusation. And that it would be rebuilt, not with human hands. And so the temple is about to become obsolete. And, you know, within a generation of Jesus' death and resurrection, it would be destroyed by the Romans. And so this tearing in two of the temple curtain could be symbolic of what will come, or what for Mark's community has already happened. And it also, though, I think, is a symbol of the fact that God remains concealed from all but a select few. And through Jesus' death, that curtain that concealed God tore apart. And that expands access to God. Not a lot, because again, it's only a slightly larger circle that would have been allowed into the actual temple itself. But it's a symbol that through Jesus' resurrection, access to God is being broadened. You know? So.
Not close somebody, you know, take off the clothes in front of a group of people. There's no, you have no dignity left.
Mm.
I took it that simply. I mean, there's a lot of other answers here, but that's how I took it.
Yeah. So it's in the moment of injustice, the chief priest exposes himself by the indignity of ripping his robes.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you can do it because something goes wrong in the court, maybe you have a rip.
Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. Sort of a little notch that would make it easier to get started. Yeah. Nancy, did you have your hand up?
You see Michael doing that with his.
Yeah, I don't know how I could tear a chasuble in part. I think it'd be better off with a phone book, honestly. That thing is thick and tough. Yeah.
You know, when I read the words in the chorus of garments, I have a picture in my head that those words are inadequate. They don't express the emotion enough. And I'm reminded, because I've watched movies so much and stuff, in the series Jesus of Nazareth, Anthony Quinn, a remarkable job. Mm-hmm. And at this moment, he stands up and rips them.
Yeah.
And it is so dramatic and powerful the way that vision mm-hmm. of him doing that. And so just to say, oh, he tore his garments, there you go. To me, have that impact.
Oh, it's
how important that was.
It's an act of sheer rage. I mean, I'm sure we've all seen the movies and the trial scene, and you know, that seems to be a consistent feature is the tearing of the robe, because in any movie you have a blending of the Gospels, but usually the screenwriters and the director are more reliant on one tradition rather than another. So I mean, for instance, Mel Gibson's Passion of Christ is heavily dependent upon John, which is where you get some of the whiffs of anti-Semitism from. John's on the verge of being an anti-Semitic gospel, because by that time, this late in the tradition, after the Jewish Christians had been expelled from synagogue and declared anathema, which is basically a condemnatory curse, John's writing his gospel. There's a lot of bad blood, and it's the bulk of the blame in John almost all of it for Jesus' crucifixion is placed on them. Pilate gets very soft treatment by John. Very soft. Go ahead.
There's a question. When it says the high priest began to ask him instead, "Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?"
Mm-hmm.
Is there? I don't remember any other times in the Bible where God is referred to as the Blessed.
He is, especially in the Psalms. They had all these, you know, names were big back then. You know, Simon being essentially nicknamed or renamed by Jesus as Peter, which comes from Petros, which means rock, which probably has a dual meaning of, you know, he's this rock, you know, sort of the principal disciple, but also that, you know, we talk about people being as dumb as a rock. And so in a way, Peter, you know, was the best of a rough lot. Saul, after his conversion experience, becoming Paul. And Jesus, when he's exercising demons, I especially think of chapter 5 of Mark when he's exercising the Gerasene demon. He wants to know the demon's name, and the demon says, "Legion." That was standard exorcistic practice. If you know the name of the demon, you can control it. Because names have a performative power. All right. So that's why saying Yahweh, that was such a big deal. Now, no one believed that you could control Yahweh by uttering Yahweh's name. I mean, he's in a class by himself. But to stay on the safe side, they came up with all of these names. Lord, Elohim, which we end up with Jehovah because of Latin, but Jehovah is not a real word. It's Elohim. And all of these are descriptor terms of God. In the prayer book, and maybe in your Bible, when you're looking at the Psalms, if you see Lord in all caps, the original Psalm says Yahweh. That's why Lord is in all caps. Blessed One, they had a load of them because they wanted to be respectful of the majesty of God. It's kind of like, you know, you wouldn't walk into the Oval Office and call the President Donnie. You just wouldn't do that. You just don't have that measure of familiarity. It's a very, very powerful office. And so take that and multiply it to the nth degree, and that's how careful they were about how they addressed and referred to God. Which I think is a marvelous thing.
Mm-hmm. So is that practice ongoing in Judaism? The reason I'm asking is because I can't remember. I sang at a Jewish temple for 20 years, not just for their holidays, and I don't remember them using the word God in place of Yahweh. And I'm wondering if just in casual speech, if Jews still do that, or if they, flip-flop in without any real reason.
Well, I don't know, to be honest. I don't have any... I have a Jewish neighbor, but we don't really talk theology a lot. She's not an observant Jew. I think they'd use the word God. I mean, it's just a generic term, but in worship they'd probably use Lord, or more specifically Hebrew terms like Adonai or Elohim or things like that. But you'll never, never catch anybody saying Yahweh. I mean, if a Jewish person was in here right now, they'd be really upset that I've said that several times already. And the people on the more orthodox end of the spectrum would probably be wondering why I've not been incinerated by lightning yet.
They'd be ripping their clothes.
Yes, they would.
Jesus said, I am, which said that he was with God, which Moses, God told Moses, I am, just telling people I am.
Yeah.
So I think that sort of relates back to the Old Testament and Moses.
Yes. If your translation in verse 62 said, Jesus said, I am, in Exodus, when Moses is in the wilderness in front of the burning bush and God sends him to Egypt, where he's a wanted man for committing murder, he says, I don't want you to go back to Egypt. I want you to talk to Pharaoh, and I want you to tell him to let my people go. And Moses has a lot of objections, understandably. And one of them is, well, who's going to believe me? I mean, which God am I supposed to say sent me? And God says, I am who I am. And the Gospel of John in particular sits on that pony and rides it hard. Jesus repeatedly refers to himself as I am. I am. John has a very high Christology. In other words, John is more focused on the divinity of Jesus than the humanity of Jesus. It's a matter of balance depending upon who you're talking to, what you want to say, and what your underlying theology is. But Jesus refers to himself repeatedly as I am, I am, I am, I am. And so, you know, I think that this could easily be an indication that his response, if it is I am instead of you say so, or you say that I am, that in doing this it would be even more suggestive to the high priest and all the rest that he's making a divine claim for himself, because that would have had to have tickled their ears. That's a good observation. Thank you. Lots of good observations going on today. Anything else we got?
As to the computer first, this translation says that he began to call down curses on himself.
Okay.
I kind of like that better than if he were cursing Jesus.
Yeah.
It's like he's so disgusted with what he's doing.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it could be that that's a translation relying on a source that wants to clarify in order to avoid the awkwardness of the idea that Peter would be cursing Jesus. It's hard to say. If you want to jump into 15, we can, and then we can review it in greater detail next week. But the parallels between Jesus' first trial and essentially his second, very brief trial before Pilate, are remarkable. And so what we'll do is we'll just cover the first 15 verses and I'll remember what I can. As soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He answered him, "You say so." Then the chief priests accused him of many things. Pilate asked him again, "Have you no answer? See how many charges they bring against you." But Jesus made no further reply, so that Pilate was amazed. Now at the festival he used to release a prisoner for them, anyone for whom they asked. Now a man called Barabbas was in prison with the rebels who had committed murder during the insurrection. So the crowd came and began to ask Pilate to do for them according to his custom. Then he answered them, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he realized that it was out of jealousy that the chief priests had handed him over. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him release Barabbas for them instead. Pilate spoke to them again, "Then what do you wish me to do with the man you call the king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "Crucify him!" Pilate asked them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him!" So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released Barabbas for them, and after flogging Jesus, he handed him over to be crucified. So, The cock crows twice, it's dawn, Peter's weeping, and the chief priests, elders, scribes, and the whole council hold a consultation. And what they're almost certainly talking about is, let's take in the pilot. How are we going to handle this? Now, they had the authority to put somebody to death for certain offenses. What they didn't have the authority to do was to crucify someone. If they were going to kill somebody, they had to stone them to death or something like that. But crucifixion was something the Romans reserved as their own prerogative. It was pretty much the worst way to die. I mean, you could argue that being impaled was worse, but you know what impaling is, don't you? Yeah. But really, it wasn't in as much practice in the Roman Empire. That was more something they did off to the east. Crucifixion was it was designed as a very stark warning to anybody who think that they might want to cause trouble, which I think is why the Romans reserved it to themselves. It was a way of expressing their power over subjugated peoples. In some of the larger rebellions, they would crucify people along the roadside, roughly about a mile apart. They didn't have a mile back then, but it was like X number of stadia, which comes out to almost a mile. So as you're walking down the road, you see these people in agony, or you see these dead, rotting bodies. And by the time you've gone very far, you're quite clear that you need to behave yourself. They take Jesus bound to Pilate, and, you know, Pilate, really a sort of a perfunctory interrogation. So are you the King of Jews or not? Obviously anybody who would have declared himself to be the Messiah would have been declaring himself to hold a monarchical role, because the expectation of people was that the Messiah would be a Davidic-like figure. They accused him of many different things, so a lot of this false testimony seems to have resurfaced. And Jesus, apart from saying to Pilate, "You say so," when Pilate asks him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" You know, in a way, that's a clever answer, because he's not directly saying that. He's saying, "Well, that's what you say." And it's interesting because it's almost as if Jesus is saying, by even asking the question, you know what the truth is. You know, you wouldn't be asking that question. I wouldn't have been accused of that if it weren't so. Pilate's amazed by the fact that Jesus won't defend himself. His life's on the line. He tries to find a way out. And he does so through a process that doesn't actually seem to have happened. The idea in the Gospels is that every year at the Passover, the people would be given a choice of two prisoners, and which one do you want released? And then he would release that person, and it was sort of a sign of leniency. And there's no indication in non-biblical sources that this actually happened. And it would have been illogical to do so. I mean, you're responsible for a region of the Roman Empire. And yeah, you need to work on your public relations. But are you really going to release an apprehended criminal to a crowd? And if you're going to release an apprehended criminal, why would you choose somebody like Barabbas? Obviously, he probably had more than one prisoner at his disposal. Maybe if, you know, he decided in this instance to do this, you know, if it wasn't a regular thing, it doesn't mean that it didn't happen at all. So maybe he said, well, maybe this is a way out where I don't have to kill this guy who seems to be innocent to me. Maybe he picked Barabbas because he thought, this guy is so awful. I mean, this is like the scum of the earth. So naturally, they'll choose this Jesus guy. He's just a little off in the head. That's his only problem. And, you know, he might have been very well aware that the crowds, just several days before, had cheered him into Jerusalem. You know, so Barabbas was part of a rebellious group that had murdered people during the insurrection. This is not referring to the rebellion that began in 66 AD. Okay, remember, these events are occurring in the early 30s. Although the figure of Barabbas would have been highly resonant with Mark's community, there were ongoing insurrections of varying degrees, and at times they would boil over. Okay, there was a lot of politically motivated banditry. There were assassinations of prominent figures. And apparently Barabbas was somebody who had gotten involved in one of these lower level instances where it was so common and so kind of low grade that historians like Josephus just don't even bother mentioning it, you know. And so he basically gives them a choice. He's aware that, you know, the chief priests are jealous of Jesus. Pilate would have needed, especially at the Passover, to be aware of kind of the pulse of the people. So it's entirely possible that he had heard of Jesus because he was very popular with the crowds. But the chief priests managed to manipulate these crowds to get Barabbas out instead of Jesus. We don't know how. But the contrast here is between a populace that originally had welcomed Jesus versus one that's demanding that he be crucified. And not just that Barabbas be released, but that Jesus be crucified. I mean, there may have been other alternatives. I mean, a lot of times they just, you know, torture you and then let you go. Or they'd put you in prison, or they'd exile you. There are a lot of other alternatives to crucifixion, you know, because he's not asking, what do you want me to do with Jesus? He's saying, actually he does ask them, what do you want me to do with Jesus? But there's a range of options. I mean, there's an implied option by him saying, what do you want me to do with this guy? And, you know, and of course, I'm sure Jesus wasn't universally popular in Jerusalem. In fact, most people probably didn't know who he was. And there's no way of knowing if there were people in this crowd that were in the crowd that welcomed him into Jerusalem in his triumphal procession. There could be no overlap at all. But it's a contrast that, in a way, echoes Peter's denial and betrayal of Jesus. And so he says, what do you want me to do with the man you call the King of the Jews, or just the King of the Jews? The textual, there's textual variance there in the oldest sources. And he wants to know, well, why should I crucify him? I mean, what's this awful thing that he's done? But now Pilate has exactly what he does not want in Jerusalem at the Passover. He has a riled up crowd. And so he's kind of in checkmate. So he lets Barabbas go, he flogs him, and then he hands him over to be crucified. And flogging was brutal. In fact, a lot of people just died from it. They would have probably started with canes. You know, it's in the, is it Singapore, where they still cane people? And I mean, you can get caned for like spitting your gum out on the sidewalk. I think I read that somewhere. So they basically, you know, bend you over school style and they whack your bottom with the cane. And so they would have lashed his back with canes. And then they had a device called a tripalium. Kind of like a cat of nine tails, you know, if you're into pirates and all that. This would have been made out of leather strips, and they would have embedded pieces of bone and metal and maybe pieces of broken glass. They would have sort of sewn this in. Sometimes they even, like, studded these strips with these sharp metal hooks, kind of like a fish hook. And so you'd be lashed with that, and then as they pulled the lash away for the next strike, it would have started stripping not just your skin, but they could have easily, very easily stripped you right down to the bone. It would have been absolutely agonizing. And it's believed that Jesus did not last long on the cross because he was extensively tortured. You know, the cross was designed for many purposes, and one of the reasons they used the cross was it took you a really long time to die. Sometimes it took days for people to die up there because you don't bleed out. You don't dehydrate because they try to keep you hydrated. I mean, they've got a jar of sour wine around with a sponge and a stick, you know, because when you're thirsty, they want to give you something to drink because the more you drink, the more you suffer. And of course, you can't starve to death just in a matter of days. You die from the accumulation of fluid in your lungs because all the muscles you use to breathe are compromised by the position that you're in on the cross. And in fact, that still happens. Putting a person's hands above their head, tying them together, and then hanging them like on a beam or a piece of pipe, that's a torture practice that's still used today because it's very uncomfortable and it gets very, very hard to breathe. This flogging that he would have received would have been brutal. And despite the many elements of Mel Gibson's film that I dislike, he probably most accurately and graphically portrays what a flogging would have been in first century Palestine more than any other movie does, just because he's willing to go there. And I do have to give him some kudos for that. It's quick, it's simple, sort of event in the sequence, and Pilate plays a cameo role at best in this. And it's possible that Mark, unlike some of the other Gospels, restricted Pilate's role because, remember, he's writing to people during or after a major rebellion. And we've talked about how Jewish people, whether they were Christian or not, were catching hell from the Gentiles. And Jewish Christians were getting it from both sides because they didn't help out with the rebellion. That just wasn't their way. They didn't believe these false messiahs, these false prophets. They weren't concerned about the preservation of the temple and the old ways of doing things because they'd found a new way. So these zealot Jews were after him. And since this rebellion was more than an anti-Roman but also an anti-Gentile rebellion, all Gentiles would have had very negative feelings for Jewish people. So Pilate's role in this is significantly minimized, but it's also because Mark is very compact. You see greater elaboration in Matthew, Luke, and John. It's just a real tight gospel. Yes, Peter.
Did the Jewish authorities, if they had him up for blasphemy, they could have stoned him to death quite happily. Mm-hmm. And nobody would have said anything. Mm-hmm. Why did they decide to take him in front of Pilate? Did they have it fixed that Pilate would?
Well, I think it's hard to say. I mean, maybe they wanted Pilate's sanction. Caroline, what do you have?
Well, I would say that, you know, Jesus had a lot of followers. Mm-hmm. And so politically, it was better for them if Pilate was, the Romans were seen to have crucified him, than they.
Yeah.
Because of all of his followers and all his people.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it would be a combination of things. One, maybe they wanted him crucified as a more public example, and they wanted him to suffer. I mean, in a stoning, you know, one good stone to the head and you're unconscious, you know, and then you're just basically battered to death. So the crucifixion would have been a worse way to go. By enlisting Pilate's help, that gives them cover. So, you know, if they stone him to death, the people with whom he's popular could blame this on the council. But if Pilate declares the death sentence and has him crucified, people are going to be less likely to resist him because of the sheer danger involved in it. They might have been trying to ingratiate themselves with Pilate. There was a collaboration there. Any conqueror has to have collaborators. It's absolutely essential to have local collaborators. And the Sadducees in particular, along with the priesthood, they were it. Because what they held in common with Pilate, although they wished he was dead and gone and the Roman Empire destroyed by God, what they had in common was the maintenance of the status quo. They both had an interest in maintaining the status quo and to keep things calm. You know, it's hard for Rome to collect taxes and facilitate commerce, you know, if the province is a mess. Well, it's also kind of difficult, you know, if there's a low intensity war going on to function in the temple. You know, so they had that in common. And, they saw him as a troublemaker. So from their own perspective, they might have thought, this guy is potentially a serious cause of trouble. And so the natural thing to do, because he's a political criminal, he's declaring himself to be a messiah, he's declaring himself to be a royal figure, the sensible thing to do would be to hand him over to Pilate and say, this guy's seditious. We think it might be in everybody's best interest if he was killed or somehow silenced. So their motives aren't entirely clear, but I think that we can be fairly confident in our speculations that they had a number of different motives, but chief among them, self-protection, and maybe secondarily, sort of a cruel vindictiveness. I mean, stoning was far from pleasant, I'm sure, but crucifixion was a lot worse. Yeah.
What about this betrayal of Pilate? I have a little note here that says Pilate was, other sources say that he was one of the most vindictive and violent of the Roman governors.
Yeah, you know, eventually he got fired. I can't remember when they tossed him out. It wasn't too long after this, late 30s, early 40s at the latest. But he wasn't especially good at his job, and because his job was to keep the peace. And what would happen is there a problem would arise. He would overreact, and it would just make the problem worse. Okay. He was just clumsy. And there were some non-biblical historical sources that would say, well, not so much. You're just exaggerating this. But the image that I get in all of the Gospels when it comes to Pilate is that, you know, he's got a lot of responsibility. This could not have come at a worse time for him. I mean, they are on red alert. Okay, it's just like July 4th. If there's going to be a big terrorist attack, it's probably going to happen on July 4th. Okay, and so everybody's on red alert. If there's going to be trouble, it's going to be during the Passover. You know, Jerusalem's horribly overcrowded. It's the highest festival of Judaism. They're not happy about us being here. There's always this sort of low-grade terrorism, is how the Romans would have interpreted it, going on. And so if something big's going to happen, this is going to be the day. All furloughs canceled. Double shift. You know, all that. So he's probably, I can just imagine Pilate, and in a way, because you see him sort of like, oh God, let's get this over with. You know. Because just, it's boom, boom, boom. It happens pretty quick. And, you know, this is just one more thing on his desk. You know. So how can I dispatch this quickly? I've got more important things going on. That's how I see Pilate in all the Gospels, even in the others where he plays a broader role, and especially in John where he's very reluctant to do this. It's that very reluctance that he shows in John that in my mind demonstrates to me that he just wants to get this over with. I mean, yes, he has his misgivings, but okay, chop chop, let's get this taken care of. He's just like any administrator. He wants it off his desk.
It's amazing that his name has become, you know, we say it in the creed every Sunday, his name is famous throughout the world.
Well, he is responsible. I mean, he could have stopped it all. Really, it's arguable that this very dispassionate, apathetic treatment would be worse than a vindictive cruelty. I mean, this was just a careless crucifixion. You know, well, okay, so this is the easy way out. This is the most probable way of maintaining the status quo, so off to the cross he goes. And of course that portion of the creeds, both the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed, the one about Jesus is the longest one, and it contains the most historical information, because these creeds were generated as a way to define who Jesus is as a person who is both fully human and fully divine. And it's just like any story. The more detail you can include, the more credible it is. And for this to work, there has to be certain historical events that you can hang your hat on. And so that's why the middle creed, the middle section of both creeds is longer than the other two combined. Because the creeds were written for the specific reason to say, these ideas about Jesus are wrong. These are the ideas about Jesus that are right. And of course, as these creeds were being generated, there was a lot of controversy around the actual historical events. And so that's why they insert these things. But it reminds me of the wonderful song from Jesus Christ Superstar. What has it go? I dreamed I met a Galilean, a most peculiar man. He had that look you very rarely find, the haunting, haunted kind. I asked him to say what had happened, how it all began. I asked again, he never said a word, as if he hadn't heard. And then the room was full with wild and angry men. They seemed to hate this man. They fell on him and then disappeared again. And then I saw thousands of millions crying for this man. And then I heard them whispering my name and leaving me the blame. I mean, it's the most poignant song in the entire musical. I mean, you just go away feeling sorry for the guy. Yeah. Well, it's 11 o'clock, so we have intermission now.